Hello, everyone. This is Cassie Burns, co-founder of All Your Data. I'm an attorney who's been using AI and machine learning for 10 years. I love data and love talking to people about data, and that's what this podcast is about. Each episode of Cassie and will feature a new guest. Each guest comes from a different background with a different approach and attitude towards technology. We'll talk about their experiences and hopefully we'll learn a thing or two. Thanks for joining. Let's get started with Cassie and
Veronica
of data.
Veronica.
And that's what this.
Wow. Sorry about that. I am suffering some technical difficulties. I am so sorry. Veronica Krizova.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
There's never enough of a pause, so it's okay.
This is a production house of one, so it can always get a little tricky sometimes. But Veronica, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Cassie and. We connected on LinkedIn because we are both attorneys who are obsessed with AI. So with that, I would love for you to give a little bit of a bio, tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so first of all, thank you very much, Cassie, for having me. I enjoy your podcast as a listener, and it's always very enlightening, so I'm very glad to be here. Yeah, you already mentioned that we are both attorneys, IP attorney with international background, and lately I have been focusing on everything law and AI for a couple of years now, because as you know, one thing leads to another. And once you are in the area of creative industry and technology, it's just, you know, natural match. So most of my clients these days come from either film industry or fashion industry, but I also focus on AI in education, on ethical AI from global perspective. And recently I became a member of the US Department of State AI Connect program. And I'm very, very grateful and happy to be there. And I hope to learn much more about regulation of AI in other regions apart from Europe, such as the United States, where I've been already focusing on the US regulation for some time now, but there are other regions that are really interesting in regulation and their approach to AI, such as Southeast Asia or other regions. So that's it.
That's it. That is not just it. So I would love for you to describe that Department of State program a little bit more, because it sounds incredibly exciting.
Oh, it really is, Cassie. It has been developed in cooperation with Atlantic Council, and we are the second cohort. And basically, these are selected individuals from around the world who focus in AI. More than half of the members come from governmental agencies, either directly from governments or some agencies focused on development of AI regulation in respective states. And we have private webinars, we have field trips, there should be a conference, and there's so much to learn. There are speakers from the American government, from OECD, from governments around the world. We have head of a department from Japan. There's ton to learn, really.
And that's the challenge. You know, we don't have enough time to learn everything we want to learn. There's just a world, just a tsunami of information. And it's very difficult to know what do we want to prioritize to look into, because we can't do it all. And that's kind of a theme for this episode, because I feel like you and I could talk about so many things. I did not realize that you had clients in fashion. So I feel like we could have a whole separate episode about fashion tech, something I'm very interested in. But anyway.
Anytime, Casey.
Okay. That isn't why we're here. We started up a conversation, I think, in the comments of a post talking about postmortem personality rights. And this really is coming up in the context of deepfakes, and not necessarily just the unauthorized or fraudulent use of deepfakes for threat actors, but also the creation of maybe it's hyper-realistic AI avatars, maybe we don't call those deepfakes, but quote unquote, maybe authorized renderings of people who maybe have passed or maybe not authorized. I feel like it's like a whole new conceptual legal issue we are having to deal with, or maybe some people don't even realize yet. But can you describe how you see postmortem personality rights from your perspective?
Yeah, I'm happy to only, it's, as you already mentioned, it's extremely complex topic itself. To illustrate it better to someone who maybe isn't as much familiar with the topic, it may be worth to divide the issue based on the actors. So there are first creatives and performing artists whose interests in this topic are very different from every one of us, and their risks they pose career-wise and personally are much different from ours. Not necessarily more severe. Each one has its own perspective. Then you have influencers and public figures whose, again, maybe their creative autonomy isn't threatened as much as with performing artists, but also they share with them the commercial interests in synthetic media and their true offline self, at least with some of the performing artists who opt in to monetize their creative and off-screen or off mic personality. And then, as I said, you have every single one of us who, for different purposes, may want to have control over their digital avatars when the person is gone. There is this concept of digital mourning, which is still evolving and it's falling to the uncanny valley still for most of the people, but I see there might be future in that, and at least some people see it as an option to leave their memories behind and to be here in a way for their next of kin or even for grandkids to share the stories, you know. And we saw the technology already, but the question is whether the society is ready and whether the law is ready. But the issues are real, right? We see actors being used for UK TV series without even knowing about it. We see commercials using actors who has been long been gone based on consent given by their children.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the uncanny valley aspect of this that you mentioned. So uncanny valley, in essence, is a phenomenon where robotics or AI, in initial earlier iterations, it's usually not sophisticated to look a lot like a human, right? It's obvious that it is what it is. It is a digital rendering. It is a robot. And as the technology advances, it gets closer to looking like a human, and that creates an uncomfortable reaction in humans. So I think the point you make is a great one. AI, we're seeing a lot of demos of AI and how great it is, but I think in the everyday practice of it, it's still not quite there yet to be so seamless and so perfect where you think like an AI avatar that's speaking and talking and has maybe memories of someone potentially. It's not there yet, but we're not too far away from that. If you look at Midjourney, the advances that Midjourney has made in the quality of the outputs for humans, it's incredibly impressive, the progression cycle there. So I think you're right that we're not quite there yet, but we're not too far away. And I love that you broke it up in those three categories. I'd like to talk a little bit about the regular person, because I think that's a latent issue or a subversive issue that people aren't aware of. And it things come into play, like trust in estates come into play, even just realizing you have this right, and maybe it is a recognized legal right, and maybe it isn't. So that's a lot to unpack for, I think, a person off the street.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. And not even from person without, let's say, legal background, even for those with legal background and within the profession itself. I'm speaking of attorneys and notaries mainly. I have these discussions with colleagues from abroad or from the Czech Republic, and vast majority of them isn't really familiar with the technology, which is one part of the knowledge we should be ready to acquire. Because just imagine, right, as a from procedure point of view, you need to know what is on your desk, right? You need to know what you are going through. And that's only if you take it as a digital asset, let's say likeness, the digital avatar that was developed for you while you were alive for whatever reason, right? You have to understand the tech. You also have to understand, let's say, the psychological or social background, the approach and the wishes of the person who left these either asset or digital persona. If you want to, you know, these are like two different things as I see it. You either leave the whole avatar for your family with given instructions how to use it, or you break down your commercial personality to different digital assets that you want to be used in a specific way. And as I see it, you should have to say. But then we should also understand the law, and that's maybe the trickiest part, because it's so much fragmented still in the United States, although there are proposals for federal protections. It is, as you said, we are still not there, as with Midjourney isn't there yet for the full, for the really, sorry, really believable experience. And the law is still on its way. And it's so fragmented also in the Europe. We do not have a right of publicity or personality rights in the EU. It's a state-based. And then you have different regulations also in other regions. So it's so much depending on where the person either had domicile or where they had primary country of interest. And still the laws are on its way.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, we're talking about right of personality, right of publicity, right of privacy. And historically in the US, those protections are for people who are alive, right? Those rights exist as you're alive. And the theory, as I recall, is that someone living, you don't want to make them uncomfortable. As a living person, you have a right to live your life without someone infringing on your private day-to-day or your likeness. But once you've passed away, historically, those rights don't necessarily continue on. Now, we've seen some people who are ahead of their times, Robin Williams being one. He wrote in his will that his estate couldn't approve use of his likeness for, I think, 10 years or 20 years or something like that. But historically, that's not been a right that people were aware of or was even necessarily enacted or approved by. Do you see kind of, knowing that you're in this cohort, are you seeing the tide changing from a policy perspective, that lawmakers are realizing this is a right that maybe didn't exist before, and maybe concepts of consent didn't exist before, and we need to create new laws or update existing ones to address that?
That's a very interesting question, Cassie. First of all, me coming from the continental Europe, the whole concept of privacy in the United States was quite a fresh experience for me when I studied at UC Berkeley, because you saw that it's completely different from how we see it in Europe. We tend to be more, let's say, private law-wise, right? The protection of privacy is much stronger in most of the European countries, whereas free speech seemed to have more say in the United States. And as you said, from my perspective, that might also be the reason, because you don't want to stifle creativity, you don't want to stifle journalism, you don't want people or their next of kin to benefit from, I'm trying not to use the word asset, but for something that has some sort of value that others could use, not necessarily commercially, but again, creatively or for public good, right?
Right.
But there were states, as far as I'm aware, in the United States who offer post-mortem protection of right of publicity, but those are only a few states. And that's what I see as the biggest problem for mainly for performing artists. It's such a patchwork, and really rights of different performing artists may differ from others doing exactly the same thing based on the state. But I see there will be development not only in the United States, but also in other countries, because the technology is so widespread, and the democratization of synthetic media technology maybe will help to push through the regulation, because there are so many cases we see now. And even as you mentioned, Robin Williams, who was one of my favorite actors since the childhood, he was quite an innovator with his will. But unfortunately, even that will was later on broken. And I read an interview with his daughter recently, how shattering experience this is when you see your father's voice and likeness being used for commercial purposes, without, not only without his consent, but against his express will. And he had fair reasons to do this. You know, he's been battling for many years against use of his work and his voice and his likeness and his name for commercial purposes. He wasn't a big fan of merchandising. And I think that everyone should have this free choice. I'm not saying that one is better than another, but you should have the choice.
Yeah. And I think an example of that where, you know, that dissonance or the impact it has on families, we're seeing that more recently with the George Carlin stand-up comedy special, George Carlin being a comedian who, I mean, he's been passed away, I think, easily 10 or 15 years. And someone created, in essence, like a generative AI version of him, his likeness, his voice, and a stand-up routine that was drafted based off of trainings of transcripts of his routines. And they published it, the people published it, and the family was very much unhappy about it for various reasons. And that's an example where that artist didn't have the foresight to that Robin Williams had. And Robin Williams, I believe it was because he was a big gamer, right? And he kind of knew. We know like gamers, gaming is really, really pushing the bounds of how we can use technology. And we're starting to see it more obviously now. But, you know, not everyone's going to be like Robin Williams. So I believe they have since, the creators of that have since scaled that back. Maybe it's not available anymore. But I think we're going to increasingly see people press those boundaries and see maybe where the policy lies a little bit. But you go ahead, Veronica, you're about to say something.
Oh, sorry. Just, you said something very important now. More people press the boundaries, it may also help the development of the law, because as we know, legislative process can be lengthy, although there are some pressing issues that need to be solved, sort of fast-tracked. But case law can also be very helpful, because there are laws that may be applicable to post-mortem protection of individuals' rights, whether it's privacy or personality rights, right of publicity. But these waters need to be tested first. And for instance, there is this case in Germany. I don't know if you heard about it. There was a tabloid who, on their cover page, they announced that there will be an interview with Michael Schumacher inside, who has been unfortunately in coma for many years. And he was famously very private person, and so is his family. And they didn't wish journalists to intrude into their lives after what happened. The tabloid basically took one of the AI chatbots and have the interview be written with the chatbot. So the misleading cover page was leading to an AI-generated interview with a digital avatar of Michael Schumacher. So what followed was that the family, as far as I'm concerned, disclaimer, I haven't been following the case later on, but I think they pressed charges against the publisher of the tabloid, or they at least said they will file a lawsuit. I think that's more like it. And then the editor-in-chief, who was responsible, obviously, for the content, she lost her position. She was made redundant, but that's about it. And my question there was, that's nice, but what about the tool itself? What about the system? You always have to look into the terms of use, right? And usually I will have the responsibility with the person using it, with the end user. And you will have teeny-weeny disclaimer that this is, by the way, this is just an AI-generated content. But many people don't really perceive it that way once they delve deeper into these profound conversations with these avatars, who, by the way, have very often likeness of the person they are mimicking in the header.
Interesting. Interesting. So I think that there's a lot there. I think that the point you make about the underlying technology, that's really the challenging piece with this, whether it's a hyper-realistic AI avatar created with consent or without consent. If you consider the without consent scenario, so maybe deepfakes, there's a lot of technology that's been available open source or available on the dark web. So really, I think shutting it down at that place is going to be increasingly difficult. I think having the laws potentially to help with that. But I'd like to go back to a comment you made about First Amendment rights. And I think that's what makes this such an interesting nut to crack, in particular obviously in the US. And I was listening to a congressional hearing on the impact of deepfakes. So again, like the threat actor scenario, and in the context of public figures. And there's that tension of giving the rights to free speech as a priority right. But now it's a new ball game here, folks. I don't think the founding fathers probably had any idea this potential possibility was out there. So I think that we're going to continue to see those tensions created between some core principles. And it'll be interesting, to your point, to see how courts deal with it, how lawmakers deal with it. But I the point you make is great. Policy can take a while, and we don't have the luxury of time on our hands right now, unfortunately. So hopefully lawmakers will get to action. So,
well, we have a super election year now, and if I'm not mistaken, more than 4 billion people globally will give their vote in one election or another. So this is very, very threatening global issue, because it can either end up by us not believing virtually in anything we see, hear, or read, or people being very easily misled. And we already saw it in the past. Yeah, also, this is very slippery slope, because AI technology has so much potential, even for educational purposes, mm-hmm. and even the avatars, even the chatbots, everything. It always comes down to how the technology is used by the users.
I want to talk about that. I want to go back to the chatbots. And the concept is you build a chatbot that is modeled after someone in your family, someone who's deceased. And the thought is they're going to have their likeness. They're going to have their voice. They may have some memories if they're recordings or something like that, to maybe be a method of dealing with grief, or maybe a method of sharing that experience of engaging with that person that meant so much to you with maybe grandchildren or great-grandchildren that came after. And I can see a lot of value in that, but I also, there's a lot of potential harm as well. And I think there are aspects of the EU AI Act that I think touch on this a little bit, the potential for manipulation and subversive use of AI. If you get into the granular nitty-gritty language around there, they specifically point out the potential harm of spatial computing and really being in that environment, and how psychologically people could get out of touch and again be manipulated. I would love to hear your thoughts on the pros, the cons, and how we navigate those waters.
Sure. I guess this will be a very difficult question for many researchers, not only in our field, but once again in social psychology, in philosophy. This is a whole new chapter of humanity. This will totally change the way we live and we connect with our close ones as a family. So first of all, what does it do to the concept of mourning, of passing, of the life as we know it? And also, if you look at it from a more legal perspective, if you are in a position of this model of, let's say, acquiring this system, or let's say finding a membership in the existing tools, which are still limited, obviously, but you should do your homework. You should think of what will happen with the data when you are gone. What is the, let's say, fitness of the company? Who is the processing party of the data? You just want to do your background check before you even apply or sign up for this system. Then you should think of the executor of your will, if you want to have specific scenario when, how, and for which purpose should this avatar or AI tool be used. And also you should think of what will happen if you ever change your mind. And you don't want certain memories to be part of the AI memory. And then again, it's more maybe a philosophical question. We maybe have right to be forgotten, and we may be entitled to a right to be remembered. But should we have full control? How aren't we then changing our personal history, right? Can we delete something from how people will remember us? I don't know. I guess it's too complex to answer.
It's a lot. Just hearing you talk about it, it makes me think. I had to sit for the bar exam in Texas again like 2 years ago, and sitting through the real estate and life tendencies and all of that in the U.S., I was really annoyed by it because I'm like, ugh, I don't even have assets to think about like that. But what if we thought about these digital assets like that? Like my next generation, I want to keep it, but after they pass, maybe do away with it. And then nearly like algorithmic disgorgement, I want it destroyed, or maybe you want it retained for posterity. But I could see there being kind of a, what if the next keepers of my digital likeness, what sort of controls do you have beyond them, who, to people who may not have known you personally and may not have known philosophically, Cassie would never have wanted to have been included in XYZ. So I think it creates a lot of interesting philosophical legal issues or novel issues that we've not had to deal with. And we don't obviously know the answer to it. But on the flip side, it could be a great resource, the AI for good, as you said, that we have an increasingly aging population that's dealing with loneliness, that's dealing with maybe mental issues related to dementia or things like that. And how could even some of these, you know, maybe not talking about the people after they pass, but people who are living and wants to be surrounded by their old friends who maybe have passed. I could see the benefit to that. My parents live with my husband and I, and they're not working a 9-to-5, so they get lonely, they get bored. And what if it's a mechanism to keep their brain a little bit lively and things like that? I could see value there. There's just a lot, like you said, psychologically to unpack there, ethically to unpack there, and legally to unpack as well.
I really like both of the points you made, actually. Let me start from the back in a reverse order. A few years back, I met this professor at a conference who used to work for IBM, and now they have their own AI company. And he told me that he was inspired by watching his father talking to electronic vacuum cleaner to develop an AI system that would be a companion checking on the elderly people, whether they took pills at the times they were supposed to, and also providing some, let's say, social interaction. I see great benefit of it, but we will have to be extremely careful, not only ethically, but also legally. We don't need to go into details, but European regulation, whether it's the regulation that is in place or the AI Act, I think there will be discussions about this specific use of AI, whether it's companionship or, let's say, psychological or mental healthcare assistance, mental well-being. There are a few applications that are based on AI already. And I think putting them on the European market isn't without some considerations to be taken into account, because the AI Act works extraterritorially. If you, whatever is on the European market needs to be in compliance with the AI Act. And also, it is definitely a complex issue, and there are several approaches on to how to keep the control over your data with you. So obviously, performing artists, they are experimenting with the concept of collective rights management, whether this shouldn't be a new right, new, let's say, copyright to your likeness, voice, and your performance that should be managed by collective management organizations, collective rights management organizations. The other option that may be better, because it can cover rights of anybody, is to have some external executor of the will, and perhaps use blockchain and just have a set of technological and legal rules that will secure that your explicit instructions will be met as long as the right is here. Because, for instance, with the No Fakes Act, if I'm not mistaken, it extends only for 7 years after the death of the person. So I think one of the states, if it was Tennessee, or I don't know, it has 100 years. So the question is, what is the appropriate time span of the rights protection? as you said, so many questions.
There's so much, and I love the idea of blockchain to solve these issues. I'm a big proponent. I conceptually think that. And then you could have a smart contract that could be programmed to, at the end of life of that digital asset, it automatically gets that done. But so many ways that can go. Now, I'd like for you to talk a little bit more about digital agency. This is something we chatted about. And conceptually, I think it's a whole different thing. The idea, again, we're talking about things that are very old practices of law, trust and estates, maybe asset, like real estate asset concepts transferred over to digital assets in some way. Do you think that's kind of the framework like we need to be thinking about it? You talked about it just a little bit ago, that digital agency, the digital agency of things that we're creating.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think this will be the next big thing. We just have to wait a bit for it. Just when you see on how digital assets are being managed now when it comes to estates management, it still will be the same list of passwords and accounts as with the properties and the number of cups on a cupboard. It seemed to be very outdated. And I know there are alternatives, but I guess they will eventually find their way to the daylight. And it will become a new norm as I see it, because with a Web3, which may or may not be a bubble, I think there's some of it will survive. And just imagine that you would have the alternative world where all of your digital assets are collected in your digital realm with your digital avatar. So how do you tackle that then with the list of, you cannot use the list of passwords to your Facebook account and your Twitter, right? Then you have also all these different rights. It's not just metaphysical question anymore. We have copyright, we have trademarks, we have all sorts of other economical rights related to your digital currency, et cetera, et cetera. And digital assets that you bought with this currency, it's just, I think there will be a lot to learn for all of us.
I can't wait. I'm excited. It's somewhat terrifying, but also exciting, because going back to your hopeful perspective, there's a lot of harm that could come, but I think there's the potential to help a lot of people in a lot of different ways. This topic is endlessly fascinating. We're getting kind of down to the end of the session, Veronica. I would love to hear your closing thoughts, whether it's tips or just something for people to be mindful of to wind down this podcast episode.
I think there is so much to learn, and this field is changing so fast. So if anyone from our colleagues is interested in the field, try to dedicate your time to following accounts, newsletters, the latest case law, legislation. And if anyone from outside the legal world is listening, try to think of your rights. You may have more than would cross your mind. So yeah, just think of your rights and how to protect them.
I think that's great. And I think anyone who wants to stay on top of things, I feel like LinkedIn is the best aggregator of updates and news about AI, especially in the context of AI policy and things like that. So I think if you're not active on LinkedIn, you might want to consider it and follow some thought leaders out there, because I mean, I find that more effective than maybe keeping an eye out there in other mediums. There's a lot of great information rolling through. Veronica, I want to thank you so much for joining us today in this episode about postmortem personality rights. And I feel like we're going to have a lot more conversations to come. And to my audience, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. And I hope you join us for the next episode of Cassie and...